I'm Howard Bryant, and this is Only a Game. Let's go back to the 2017 World Series. The Dodgers and Astros are tied at 2 games apiece. We're in the first inning of Game 5. L.A. has the bases loaded, 2 outs, when...
That's into left to base hit. One run scores. Gonzalez can't come up with it. Turner scores, and it's 2-0 L.A.
But imagine this. Instead of the Dodgers getting another chance to build their lead, the inning just ends. Slugger Yasiel Puig doesn't get to go to bat with 2 runners on and 2 out. Astros pitcher Dallas Keuchel is off the hook, all thanks to the biggest rule change that baseball has ever seen. Only a Game's Matthew Stock explains.
Wall Street Journal sports columnist Jason Gay remembers exactly where he was when he heard about an idea that could save baseball.
I was in George Clooney's sitting room.
Oh, yeah.
No, I don't know where I was.
Anyway, wherever he was, that proposal to change baseball caught his attention.
This proposal was not the work of like talk radio lunatics who are just trying to make baseball fans crazy. This is a pair of serious academics who have background in game theory, who have background in the idea of, you know, competitive fairness, who are making a real serious proposal.
Stephen Brams was one of the professors behind that email. He studies politics and game theory at New York University. His idea started with a simple number game.
The game is called Catch Up, and two players are given a set of numbers, say from 1 to 10.
Basically, you and a friend take turns picking numbers and trying to get the highest score. But as soon as you take the lead, your turn ends.
We thought it was an interesting game because nobody ever falls too far behind. Even my grandchildren can play it.
Brams and his team of academics have studied the catch-up game, and they've found ways to apply the concept in sports, starting with soccer.
If a game goes to penalty kicks, the team that kicks first on each of the 5 penalty kicks has an advantage.
This advantage is big, and to Brams, it's unfair. So he and his team used a computer program to simulate soccer shootouts and see what would happen if the catch-up rule were in place. He found that if the team behind got to go first on the next kick, the lopsided advantage went away. When they saw that the catch-up rule leveled the playing field in soccer, Brams and a co-author, Aaron Isaacson, moved on to baseball.
We thought that since baseball games are often not so competitive, that a way to help the lesser teams would be to give them a handicap, as it will.
The baseball version of the catch-up rule goes like this. If a team is trailing or tied, they get the normal 3 outs at bat. But if the team takes a lead,
Turner scores and it's 2-0 LA.
They only get 2 outs before going back on defense. The game theorists wanted to see what would happen if this rule were actually used. So they took data from old games.
From 1967 to 2007, 50 years, over 100,000 games.
And used a computer program to replay the games as if the catch-up rule had been in place.
Our analysis said that if the catch-up rule had been in place, games would have been more competitive. The difference between the winning team and the losing team would have been lowered by about 33% in runs. And the games also would be shorter by 24 minutes, which is a significant change. So if you can shorten the games and make them more competitive, they'll be more thrilling.
This was the idea that found its way into Jason Gay's inbox. He wrote a column supporting it. He didn't think it was that much of a stretch.
I was somebody who suggested allowing fans the opportunity to pitch in blowout situations as opposed to bringing in your right fielder to close out the 8th inning. Why not just grab somebody in the mezzanine to come in and do the same? I'm also on the record as being someone who supports a 7-inning weekday game. You know, if Monday through Friday, let's play 7 innings. Let's take a little bit of time off this thing. You want a 9-inning baseball game, you're going to get plenty of them on Saturdays and Sundays.
So you're not exactly a baseball purist.
No, I'm not a baseball purist. I'm an equal opportunity heretic.
And so do you think you could maybe put on your baseball futurist hat for me for a second and imagine a new universe in which this rule is the norm?
Well, I can tell you that since the publication of the article, the universe that baseball fans imagine is me being tethered to the Green Monster and being pummeled with baseball for 5 to 6 hours. Baseball fans did not take terribly kindly to this column.
For Jason, the catch-up rule stuck out as an intriguing, well-thought-out solution to problems of competitiveness and the length of baseball games. But for NBC Sports lead baseball writer Craig Calcaterra, it simply fit in with a regular trend in sports fandom.
For the most part, the baseball is broken and we have to fix baseball some way idea that gets kicked out into the universe a few times a year. It tends to happen in the fall when the NFL games start up again and they get 10 times higher ratings than baseball games do.
Unlike Jason, Craig actually does remember where he was when he first heard of Steven Brams and Aaron Isaacson's bold proposal.
As is so often the case, I was on my couch. And as is not often the case, I almost fell off of my couch. This was one that really actually caused me to sit gape mouth because I can't remember one that wanted to so fundamentally change the essence of baseball as this. Literally taking the classic three outs in an inning and disposing of it for the interest of efficiency.
Craig agrees that shortening baseball games is good for the sport, but he says there are better ways to do it.
I'm a big fan of the pitch clock. That's been adopted in minor league baseball.
And he points out that the catch-up rule doesn't actually speed up the pace of play.
That's about how long it takes for a guy to throw a pitch and whether or not there are too many commercial breaks and stuff. That wouldn't change at all. People would still be spitting and scratching and kicking and doing all those sorts of things that they do in between pitches that drive us crazy now. They'd just be doing it for fewer outs.
Craig is pretty confident that you won't be seeing the catch-up rule rock the big leagues anytime soon, which should come as a relief to Jason Gay and his readers.
Baseball fans of America, I have now received all of your all caps emails. I've heard your voices. I've heard your opposition. I love you. And let's move on.
But Steven Brams and Aaron Isaacson aren't giving up on instituting the catch-up rule in other sports. It may not be baseball that pioneers their idea, but Brams tells me that the head of the International World Squash Association might be interested.
That's Only a Game's Matthew Stock. You thought this moment wouldn't come, but it has. It's time for three stories you should know. I'm joined by the San Francisco Chronicle's Ann Killian. Welcome back, Ann.
Thanks for having me, Howard.
And by The Nation's Dave Zirin. Welcome back, Dave.
Oh, it's great to be here, Howard.
All right, I'm going to bat leadoff. Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban will donate $10 million to women's groups after a league investigation concurred with a Sports Illustrated report of decades-long misogyny within the organization. Here he is speaking with ESPN's Rachel Nichols.
You know, first, just an apology to the women involved, the women that in a couple cases were assaulted, not just to them, but their families. It stays with people, it stays with families, and I'm just sorry I didn't see it.
Much of the conversation I hear from men is they're the ones in the bullseye, that they must adopt a Mike Pence rule of never meeting with women one-on-one in order to avoid scandal. Last week, the New York Review of Books even ran a cover titled The Fall of Men, as if some great tragedy is occurring. We're witnessing, Ann Killian, a massive counterattack against women that to me is very, very dangerous.
You know, this is a story that continues to come up in all walks of life. So for Mark Cuban to be surprised it was happening right under his nose seems a little disingenuous. I feel that women are under attack, but I also think a lot of women, especially women of the new generation, are feeling more emboldened and more willing to stop letting this stuff get swept under the carpet like it has been for so long. And I, you know, you look at those gymnasts, you know, the littlest athletes on earth brought down this man, and it took them all banding together, but they found that strength. So I feel like there's a positive side of this, that there's strength in numbers and people are speaking out.
There's this lie, a great lie, that's, I think, taught to men, that they're somehow giving up power and privilege if they listen to women's voices or listen to the Me Too movement. And I think we need to fight that and have people understand that it's far more important that men and women come together to make sure that these kinds of abuses of power and these abuses of violence no longer occur in our public life, whether we're talking about the sports world or the real world.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that gets to me about this more is this notion that the guys are under attack, and also the flip side of the consequence when it comes to women. If you actually begin to believe that you can't have a meeting with a female employee, you can't have a meeting with a coworker, then they're going to be the ones who are out of opportunities. They're going to be the ones who miss out on promotions. They're going to be the ones who miss out on a lot of the social elements that enhance your career. This is dangerous stuff.
I'd agree with that. It's kind of the old, on the golf course or in the bar talking. Those are the places that women have always wanted to be able to get the promotions, to make the connections. And now there's going to be a backlash to that. There's no doubt. It's something we all have to guard against. It's absurd, but we have to.
It's also worth noting that this kind of male victimization complex, I mean, it goes back as far as the women's liberation movement in the 1960s and 70s. These aren't new ideas. I think what's different right now is that women are actually organizing themselves. And because of social media, they're able to attain some victories and shed light for a national audience.
Exactly. Here's the deal. Guys, you know what you're doing. Let's not make it seem like we're under threat. We're not. Let's go to football. Dave, your turn.
Now, recent years have seen a spate of early retirements from the NFL, of people who've chosen to walk away from pro football instead of limp. And this past weekend, however, early retirement was taken to a whole other level as Buffalo Bills cornerback Vontae Davis retired at halftime. He got dressed in his street clothes during halftime and dipped. He left the stadium. Immediately, the condemnation started flying across the football world, and typical was his teammate Raphael Bush, who said after the game, "I think I did lose a little respect for him as a man." Now, manhood in the NFL is defined by a willingness to get hurt and hurt others, even if your heart isn't in it. It took a particular kind of courage for Davis to walk away when he did. I think we need to remind ourselves that this isn't gladiatorial combat, and these aren't warriors. This is a business. As Vontae Davis said in his statement, "I shouldn't be out there anymore." And that's all anyone should need to hear.
Well, I would agree that you don't want him on the field if he doesn't want to be there. You know, it's dangerous for everyone involved. I kind of feel that he owed his teammates an explanation. I feel that to walk out in the middle of a game on a bad team that's being humiliated.
So you think he was a little unprofessional?
I would call it very unprofessional, yeah. And I think a lot of us would walk out after a half of football. I still think you owe it to your teammates to tell them how you feel instead of just dashing out the door.
Yeah, I think the part that got me was the getting dressed and walking out of the building. And I agree with you, Dave, on this, that the entire code, the manhood code, the real man code, it took a hit and it needed to take a hit.
Yeah, and I think that's the part of it that I find most interesting, because so much of masculinity in our society is constructed, I would argue, by the NFL, or that there's no cultural force that I think we need to hold accountable more than the NFL. And Vontae Davis took that and basically turned it on its head and said, "I'm going to accept every criticism. I'm going to accept everybody who says I'm not a real man." And he said, "I'm going to take all of this for the simple reason that I want to be with my family." And I thought it was great. Like, in a follow-up interview, he was asked if he was upset by the response that he received. And he was basically like, "I feel great. I'm not playing in the NFL anymore."
You know, and you saw it with Chris Borland with the 49ers. And I think one thing that we don't pay enough attention to, because we focus on the glamour and because we focus on the money, is how much this game hurts to play.
It does. And if I can, that brings me to my story. The Pro Football Hall of Fame, I'm sure you guys have covered the induction ceremony, which I find to be one of the sadder sights in all of sports. The men who were titans on the football field hobble onto the stage. Their bodies and too often their minds are broken by their work for the National Football League. This week, a group of Hall of Famers led by Eric Dickerson wrote a letter threatening to boycott the ceremonies if they don't get health care and a share of revenues. And at first glance, I was more than sympathetic with their plea. I think the players are right to be angry that Commissioner Roger Goodell receives $40 million in an annual salary, yet many of their own can't afford health care. But then I took a closer look at the letter, and I think it's more divisive than helpful. It asks for benefits only for the Hall of Famers, who are the elite of the elite, the guys who accumulated more wealth than their lesser-known teammates. Isn't football supposed to be the ultimate team game? What about all those unremembered linemen who blocked for players like Dickerson and the others? What about the close to 20,000 men who played in the NFL who aren't in the Hall of Fame? Dickerson said his request is a first step with the goal of getting benefits for all, but the letter specifically makes the request for only Hall of Famers.
I mean, the Dallas Cowboys were just valued at $5 billion.
That's right.
There is enough money to make sure that players have health care for more than just 5 years after retirement, which is currently the way the system is set up. I mean, that in and of itself is just such a slap in the face if you think about when the injuries are going to occur and accrue over the course of a lifetime. So there is a correct step in players with this kind of leverage and cultural capital, the Hall of Famers, to step forward and say this needs to change. But my goodness, is that letter narrowly written. And in that regard, it was a mistake.
And last thing for you, when you think about this, where do you think this is going to go?
Well, I think that people like Joe Montana, Jerry Rice, Kurt Warner have objected to this. So I think this effort, it's kind of hurting them. But I think all these guys are getting wake-up calls as they age. And I think there is going to be a movement. What they need to do is pass it down to the younger generation.
Yeah, and especially the younger generation, maybe some guys like Chris Borland or Vontae Davis who have decided to walk away. They could be leaders on this simply because they're recognizing the potential for what happens in the future. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been the Nation's Dave Zirin. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you so much.
And the San Francisco Chronicle's Ann Killian. Thank you, Ann Killian.
Thank you, Howard Bryant.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Hi, I'm Daniel Alarcón, host of NPR's Spanish-language podcast, Radio Ambulante. We tell engaging, one-of-a-kind stories that give you a more nuanced sense of Latin America and the U.S. Latino community today. From events that are changing the political landscape to intimate stories about everyday people. Listen to Radio Ambulante on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bless the men with holes in them, and bless the women. Bless 8 uninterrupted hours of television. The man cried while the woman laughed.
27-year-old Miko Harvey is used to getting strange reactions when he tells people he's a poet.
They like to say, I didn't know poets still existed. they like to ask you to recite a poem. I'm kind of embarrassed about it, so I try to play it down.
Harvey is a rising star in the poetry world. He won Penn Canada's 2017 New Voices Award. He was a fellow at Poets and Writers magazine. He's also got an obsession. A sports obsession, one that's led him to a pretty big question. How should society value artists? Only a Game's Martin Kessler has his story.
2 months after releasing his first book of poetry, Miko Harvey insists on showing me a YouTube video. It's an old high school highlight reel for Brooklyn Nets guard D'Angelo Russell.
Yeah, I recognize this dribble sequence from a game against Indiana. Like a year later, he would do this in a crucial possession against the Hoosiers.
This is how Miko is when it comes to D'Angelo Russell. He can tell you the exact game that Russell used a certain dribble move, plus how many points he scored, and maybe what he said in the post-game interview, too.
I Google him constantly. I've watched all his interviews, all his highlights, almost all of his games.
Now, just to be clear, D'Angelo Russell is not a superstar. He's never won an MVP award, never been on the All-NBA first team, never even been an All-Star. Yet, this is the player that Miko obsesses about constantly.
I mean, nobody thinks it's weirder than me. Like, it's the weirdest thing I do. But I would just say that most people have some weird little channel inside of themselves into which they pour kind of leftover energies or obsessions. And for some reason, all that stuff in me attached to D'Angelo Russell.
For those who grew up with Miko, this whole obsession actually isn't that surprising. I can say that with confidence because Miko's one of my very best friends. We met in 7th grade, and as long as I've known him, he's always had fascinations with semi-obscure basketball players. For one stretch of our childhood, whenever we'd play NBA Live on his PlayStation 2, Miko picked the Toronto Raptors so he could be Morris Peterson, a decent but forgettable swing man. And then there was a fixation on University of Louisville player Kyle Couric, who never even made the NBA. But none of those previous fascinations rival the intensity of Miko's current devotion to D'Angelo Russell, and none has become so intertwined with the way he thinks about his career as a poet. The story of this obsession really starts in the fall of 2009, after Miko and I parted ways for college.
It was a Friday night at Vassar, and it was like a big party night. And I was alone in my room, and kind of hiding from the party, because I was just like socially overwhelmed. And I remember I looked through the keyhole in my dorm room, looking out into the hallway.
Miko saw one of his friends, whose name I'm going to withhold for reasons that will soon be obvious.
He was on his way to throw up in the bathroom, so drunk that he was leaning on the wall. I don't know what it was, but something about that inspired me to write a poem for the first time ever. I mean, 30 seconds later, I wrote a line. Let's see if I can remember it. Okay. The narrator looks through his peephole and makes a wish to exist, a real protagonist, but the door is locked.
Poetry became Miko's passion. At first, he was too shy to tell me or his Vassar friends about it, so he'd wait till his roommate went to sleep before he started writing. But eventually, he fessed up. In 2013, Miko started graduate school at Ohio State. He was studying poetry, of course, but he also embraced the Buckeyes basketball team. And that first spring in Columbus, Miko went online and looked up Ohio State's incoming recruits.
And I saw one of them was this guy, D'Angelo Russell. And I remember watching his high school mixtape on YouTube.
D'Angelo Russell wasn't one of those unbelievable athletes who everybody knew was going to spend a year in college and then jump right to the NBA. He wasn't particularly fast. But he seemed to see the game two steps ahead of everyone else and to relish throwing a beautiful pass.
He had this silky smooth handle. He would beat you with misdirection and deception and trickery instead of power or speed. He's a poet out there, you know?
In a very abstract way, Miko could see something of himself in the way this incoming freshman seemed to value beauty for beauty's sake. But Miko tempered his expectations.
I was doubtful that he'd be able to do it on the college level once defenses got better and were game planning for him.
But that's not what happened.
Russell for three. Yes, another one.
This is a guy, he's a big risk taker, so.
Oh, look at D'Angelo Russell. You can't teach that.
D'Angelo came in immediately and was throwing alley-oops, no-look passes, and was breaking down defenders off the dribble. It was shocking how good he was.
This success seemed to send a message that it was possible to play stylish basketball, to throw a no-look pass just for beauty's sake, without sacrificing any efficiency. Now, there's a leap here, and it might be one that only a poet would make, but for Miko, seeing that made him optimistic about his own choice to pursue art.
When he's able to be his creative self and an efficient player, then I feel, okay, there's a way of existing in normal human society and writing these weird poems on my own that can coexist, and each game felt like a revelation.
Miko developed a routine at Ohio State. During the day, he'd go to class, write.
I would mingle with the poets. I would sit by the lake. I would do all the poety stuff a poet does. And then at night, I would go home, and I would stream the Ohio State basketball game on my laptop.
As D'Angelo Russell continued putting up 20 points a game while making highlight reel plays, Miko certainly wasn't the only person recognizing his skills. Russell kept rising up NBA draft boards.
With the second pick in the 2015 NBA draft, the Los Angeles Lakers select.
And when he was picked second, I was afraid that they were setting up superstar expectations on a player that, through no fault of his own, just didn't have the raw materials to do it. It just seemed like, at a certain point, the fairy tale was going to end.
So when did it become clear that, like, those concerns were correct?
It was clear immediately in summer league.
D'Angelo Russell didn't become a superstar for the Lakers. In fact, after two seasons and an infamous incident involving a secret cell phone recording, if interested, you can find plenty of content in the TMZ archives, he was traded to the Brooklyn Nets. And now?
There are moments when D'Angelo tries to throw this cross-court pass. It gets intercepted. Suddenly he looks almost like flamboyant, somebody who tried to make an aesthetic statement that failed and hurt his team. And it's not actually sustainable.
It's on these nights that watching D'Angelo Russell makes Miko question his own career choice.
Yeah, should I give up on this thing I consider artful, but is it really just selfish? And should I instead get a marketing job where I can write little ads and it will pay me more? And then I could have a child and support the child, and the human team would win. You know what I mean?
But then there are also still nights and weeks like this.
Russell directing traffic. Nice find. Instead, Russell will lob it up. Slams it down. Russell, the J. He's got it.
Sometimes he gives me the treat of a glimpse of what he's capable of, and that's superstardom, and that's a kind of genius.
So this fall, as D'Angelo Russell enters his fourth NBA season, Miko will be watching and cheering him on.
There's a question of whether there's room for somebody like D'Angelo Russell. And yeah, I feel similarly about, is there room for poets and painters and sculptors? Rooting for D'Angelo seems like a vote for art and a vote for imagination and a vote for whimsy.
Miko Harvey's first book is titled Unstable Neighborhood Rabbit. Miko's also written an essay about D'Angelo Russell, because of course he has. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. That story came from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Here's my hot take. The Baltimore Orioles need to get their act together. They're not even trying to win games. Most losses in a season since arriving in 1954, it's embarrassing. Baltimore fans, and I know you're out there, you deserve better. Do you have a hot take? Here's what I want you to do. Go to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you hear Only a Game. Leave a review of the show, of the Baltimore Orioles, of whatever you want. Your review helps others find the show. And who amongst us doesn't want to help others? Sports columnist Greg Doyle spent his summer driving around the state of Indiana looking for great stories for the Indianapolis Star. Today, we're going to give one of those stories a double play. That's what we call our occasional series that turns newspaper columns into radio dramas.
He's watching me through a window in his house and meets me just off the front porch. He's not armed, but the Shepherd Husky mix next to him will do the trick. He's holding back the giant dog with his hand. No leash, I'm noticing. Mike Morrow is squinting at me, maybe because it's a bright sunny day, and maybe because there's a stranger in his front yard. To get here, I'd climbed over his driveway fence, past the sign that shows a Siberian Husky's shadow in these words, "I make it to the fence in 2.8 seconds. Can you?" My 2.8 seconds are up.
"Can I help you?"
"Well, I'm saying, I'm here to ask you about that." I'm pointing at the barn in his gravel driveway. It's straight out of 19th century Indiana, this barn. Huge and faded red. On the lower half, a long 2x4 barricades the doors. Higher up are windows, flat on the bottom and rounded on top like you'd see on an old schoolhouse. No glass, just wooden shutters, some missing, the rest warped and crooked as a set of bad teeth.
"That?"
"Well, no, not that. Not just the barn. I point out something 10 feet up the barn, next to one of those shuttered windows. It's a basketball backboard, half-moon-shaped. The fiberglass is bubbling in places, the orange square fading away, the rim rusting around its screws. But the net looks brand new. Someone shoots on that basket on that barn in this gravel driveway here in rural Hancock County. I'm wondering who." Mike Morrow keeps squinting, his hands still behind the dog's head. The dog's eyeing me. Morrow is eyeing me. Time stops. 1 second, 2 seconds. Mike lets the dog go. His dad played basketball at Mooresville in the 1940s. Small man, son of a farmer, a point guard. Later in life, when Lewis Morrow was a machine parts inspector at the old Naval Avionics Center on the east side, he'd come home to his backyard in Old Town Lawrence and give his son what fathers in Indiana give their kids, as his father had given him. He gave Mike Morrow a love of basketball. That's why the hoop is on this old barn in rural Hancock County. after graduating from Lawrence Central, after graduating from Purdue, after becoming an electrical engineer, Mike Morrow continued Indiana's cycle of life. He got married, had two girls, taught them how to shoot baskets.
I like telling my story,
Mike is telling me, and I can tell he's surprised by this. A cautious man, you'd call him, deliberate. The kind of man to measure twice and cut once, if at all. He asked me not to identify his home's location, other than
rural Hancock County.
He's 60, his girls are grown and gone, but he prefers not to give their names. He lets me use their middle names, Marie and Joe, so they can have their privacy. Which is fine. All of it is fine. I'm just happy about the dog. Her name is Maya, and the Husky Shepherd mix had bolted from me when Mike Morrow let her go, charging to my side and leaning heavily against my legs, hoping to be petted. She's a sweetheart, Maya. Mike knew that would happen. He knows something else is about to happen, too. Mike leads me to the barn, to the basket, past the basket. Maybe he didn't understand me, I'm thinking. We leave behind the basket and enter the barn. Above us are a pair of balconies, haylofts, you'd call them. Hanging from the bottom of one loft is a child's softball bat, short and dusty. Mike's looking at me for a reaction. I'm not giving him one. What am I supposed to be seeing? He points to the back of the barn. Is there a basketball goal inside this barn? This is where they'd play in the winter. It wasn't the snow that chased them inside the barn. They'd pack it down and dribble on it. It wasn't so different from playing on gravel, but the icicles hanging from the rim. Mike Morrow poured a slab of concrete in 1998 inside the barn and hung a backboard that he and his older daughter, the one we're calling Marie, made by hand. They'd shoot baskets inside the barn, between the haylofts, sometimes from the hayloft. Killer shot and horse to spring on visiting kids. Climb the ladder to the hayloft, throw the ball down into the basket. In the summer, Mike and his girls would grab one of the half dozen or so balls lying around the driveway and play there. Both daughters played until they got to Greenfield Central and started doing other things.
We shot out here for years,
Mike's telling me.
I'll still go out there and shoot a little. I only played through the sixth grade. I was small and started playing the trumpet. I guess you'd say I didn't have a knack for the dynamics of team ball, but I could step back and shoot three-pointers.
It's an Indiana thing. So is the barn, though you're seeing fewer and fewer as the state's economy continues to veer away from agriculture. The barn is among the reasons Morrow bought this property. These 7 acres with a pond covered by a film of algae he'll swim right through. The barn is more than 100 years old, and the frame is original, but he gave it a new roof 22 years ago.
Oh, absolutely not,
Morrow says when I ask if he's considered knocking down the barn, now that his girls are out of the house and there's nobody to shoot with anymore.
It's a classic. There aren't that many of these barns.
And then he tells me something else. His older girl, Marie, she just had a girl of her own, her first child, which means Mike Morrow just became a grandfather. In a few years, that little girl will be big enough to shoot a basketball. Grandpa will have the barn ready. In Indiana, the cycle of life continues.
That was an old barn, a basketball rim, a father, two kids, an Indiana story. It was written by Greg Doyle for the Indy Star and read by actors Gordon Ellis and George Hicks. In 1978, the Chicago Sting of the North American Soccer League played a friendly in Cuba.
And I had an empty chair sitting next to me in the front row of the VIP box, which was there in case Fidel Castro came to have a look.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal. For 20 years, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has been making fun of the news with comedians and celebrity guests. We got silly limericks, we got terrible impressions. If you think the news is a joke, wait till you hear our show. New podcast episodes are available every Saturday.
I'm Howard Bryant. Coming up next week on Only a Game, the story of the Great Halifax Explosion and how that disaster led to the creation of a very successful college hockey program. But now, the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Charlie?
Howard?
Okay, next Thursday, the House Subcommittee on Crime, Terrorism, Homeland Security, and Investigation will review guidelines to open the door to legalized sports betting around the country. In addition to Nevada, 4 states have joined the sports betting industry, and Pennsylvania and Rhode Island appear to be next. I got major problems with this, Charlie. I got to tell you, I mean, we're only 10 years removed from Tim Donaghy, the NBA referee who had fixed games and shaved points and everything else. And he did time. He did 15 months. And now the doors are open for this. I don't like it. How do you feel about this?
I mean, pragmatically, they don't have any choice because the Supreme Court's blown up the law and blown it up in such a way that it's almost impossible to craft another law. So, I mean, I think you bow to the inevitable. I'm open to the argument that if you bring the underground industry above ground, you take a lot of the incentives to be crooked out of it. Obviously, the leagues are terrified of it, but I don't think
the leagues are terrified of it. I think the leagues see this as a great revenue stream as well.
Well, as long as they get their piece.
Exactly. They want their chunk of this.
Yeah. I mean, it was a revenue stream for a while. It looked like they weren't going to get a piece of it, and they were very outraged by that.
Yeah.
But now, I mean, the deals will be cut. And I don't have a problem with congressional oversight. I mean, my man Jim Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin, who's been in Congress since God was a boy, I don't know if he's altogether ready to handle the nuances of this. I've gotten to the point in my life where I don't fight against the inevitable. And I don't think that the cost of this in terms of the integrity of the sport is going to be that great. I just don't see it.
Yeah, we are in disagreement on this. I look at football, and what do we talk about every single week? Was this a catch? Was this not a catch? We talk about the rules. We're always talking about who gets home field calls and the whole thing. And now when you add this element to it, we're talking about match fixing in tennis throughout virtually every game at some point. Someone is talking about manipulation, and now that you've got betting behind it, I just don't like it.
Well, I mean, match fixing in tennis is an interesting parallel. Tennis matches do take place in countries where they allow sports betting.
That's right.
So that would be a decent point against the argument that if you legalize something, you make it essentially more honest. Again, I mean, if you can find a way to craft a law, then do it. But unfortunately, I think the Congress has looked at the Supreme Court decision and said, there's no way we can do it. We can't craft a law that will pass muster. So, I mean, I think you do the best you can with it, and you hope honesty will prevail.
For the 12th year in a row,
hey,
and I know you've been counting, Forbes magazine has rated the Dallas Cowboys the most valuable franchise in football at $5 billion. The Patriots are in there at $3.8 billion. The Patriots are okay. We get that. But point of information, the Dallas Cowboys have not won a Super Bowl since Bill Clinton's first term. 1995, when they beat the Steelers, they haven't reached the NFC title game in almost a quarter century.
But they've built a giant stadium, which they can lease to everyone.
That's right.
That apparently is all that matters.
They're getting that Beyonce money for the concerts, yeah. Right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you got Final Four money, you've got concert money, you've got
Super Bowl
Cotton Bowl every year, Super Bowl money. That will certainly appreciate the value of your franchise. It does sort of undercut the whole notion of competitive balance. If you can make your team worth $5 billion a year without winning anything.
Isn't it kind of fascinating?
Why would you spend money to win anything?
Exactly. Isn't it kind of fascinating, though, that if you're of a certain generation, you could not write the story of the NFL without the Miami Dolphins. They haven't even reached the Super Bowl since 1985.
Right.
You couldn't write the history of the NFL without the Dallas Cowboys. The Cowboys are essentially a super team in name only.
Right. I mean, you can't write the history of the NFL without the Washington racial slurs. They don't win anymore either. It's incredible the kind of money-making machine the NFL is. It's earning money to the point where its history is irrelevant now.
Well, that's right. And it's especially its history on the field because the Dallas Cowboys have not been a factor
right
in terms of a team that you had to beat to win the Super Bowl in 25 years. And finally, Charlie, you know, we like to bury the lead around here. The Cleveland Browns. I repeat, the Cleveland Browns won their first game, not just the first game of the season, but since 2016. And remember, when the Browns won their first game, they were supposed to get free beer, and they did. And here's what it sounded like.
God, for Bud Light, too.
Just for Bud Light. That's all it takes. I mean, to me personally, this is a slap in the face. I mean, they won a game. They won a game.
Well, you have to recognize that they are as authentic an NFL phenomenon as the Patriots were when they went into the Super Bowl undefeated. You're not supposed to win every game in the NFL, and you're not supposed to lose every game in the NFL. Everybody's supposed to be 8-8 or 9-7. That's the way the league is set up. So in their own way, the Cleveland Browns were an authentic phenomenon.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins us each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Howard.
Stories of sports teams that pull crazy promotional stunts are nothing new, but only a game's Gary Wallach has the story of a team that pulled off a stunt crazier than most.
In the late 1960s, the brand new North American Soccer League knew it faced a challenge: attracting U.S. fans in a country where soccer was way down on the list behind baseball, football, basketball, and hockey. That's one reason the Baltimore Bays hired Clive Toy away from his native England to run the team. As a former sports writer, he knew soccer. A few years later, in 1971, he joined the expansion New York Cosmos for their inaugural season. One of his tasks was to create excitement any way he could.
For example, I brought Moscow Dynamo in at a time when relations between the U.S. and Russia were extremely hostile.
That was in 1972.
So you can imagine the headlines, "The Russians are coming, the Russians are coming." And we had front page stories about it mentioning soccer. No other way could we have gotten soccer in those days on the front page.
But Toy found some more ways to do that. In 1977, he signed international superstars Pele and Franz Beckenbauer. He took the Cosmos on a world tour that generated splashy headlines and drew large crowds. In New York, anyway, Toy had succeeded in building a fan base. At the end of 1977, Toy left the Cosmos to join the NASL's Chicago Sting. But the Sting had no superstars. In early 1978, Toy got a call from the Cuba Soccer Federation. It wanted to bring the Sting to Havana for a friendly match, or amistoso, against the Cuban national team. Toy knew the 20-year-old embargo of Cuba by the United States could be a problem, but
it was a period when something could happen, some weakness was there, and knowing political weakness, I took advantage of it to try and get to Cuba.
The Sting were training in Haiti for the upcoming season. They had been there for weeks.
I found an old World War II Dakota troop carrier at the airport in Port-au-Prince and rented it.
Toy told the players that he had set up a friendly match with the Cuban team. Here's former Sting forward Dan McCrudden.
It was pretty hot down in the Caribbean. We were ready to be home.
Team officials pressed their case.
Hey, listen, you're the first team, the United States professional team, to go into Cuba since the 59 revolution. It's going to be a great opportunity, pretty exciting. So I think we started to get a little bit pumped for it.
McCrudden is a U.S. citizen, so he knew he wasn't allowed to travel to Cuba. Team captain Bruce Wilson, a Canadian, didn't have to worry about that. He had another concern.
It was a little bit scary, to be honest.
On March 19th, the team boarded the DC-3 Dakota.
It was an older, rickety-looking thing and sounded like an old and rickety thing.
The transport plane circled Cuba several times, leaving the team to wonder if there were clearance issues or worse. Wilson remembers the first thing Toy did when they arrived at the airport.
Clive Toy was very happy to get his supply of cigars.
I asked someone, I said, you know, does anyone have a cigar on them? And the guy said, how many do you smoke? And we all had a good laugh and a good chat.
Toy talked up the airport officials while players passed through customs. On the way to the team hotel, McCrudden and Wilson took in the sights of Havana from the team bus.
We were looking around and it was like all these old U.S. cars from like the 1950s that you'd seen in pictures.
The pollution was absolutely rampant. Everywhere you looked, there were soldiers.
The Cuban hosts took them on tours of the city.
It couldn't have been pleasanter. It was, in many respects, a typical visit by a soccer team to play a soccer game.
But in other respects, it wasn't. One night during a walk, Dan McCrudden wandered onto a street behind the team hotel.
And we're looking at this thing that's covered, had a cover on it. We weren't exactly sure the first day what it was. And then some part of the second day during our walk, they actually had taken the top off to do something with it, and it turned out to be a missile. At some point, those missiles were pointed to the United States.
McCrudden says that idea, along with the constant military presence in Havana, was disconcerting. But conversations with Cuban citizens were welcome diversions.
They were actually pretty eager to talk to us, knowing that we were Americans. And so we had a lot of very friendly people coming up to us and talking to us about what it was like to live in the U.S.
One night at a nearby park, one of the locals made a business proposition.
He said he'd buy our jeans from us.
Levi's were as hard to come by in Havana as Cuban cigars were in Chicago. But the negotiations never got underway.
All of a sudden, he takes off. And then the next day when we see him, he said that we were being followed by the Cuban government, by the secret police.
Neither McCrudden nor Wilson encountered the secret police. Not that they knew of, anyway. And after 2 days of training, sightseeing, and avoiding international intrigue, it was March 21st, game day.
Entre Cuba y Estados Unidos, empiezan a desfilar ya a los acordes de la marcha símbolo.
You know, there's a little pomp and circumstance prior to us starting the game. So there was a little parade of the Cuban team and us marching out with our flags.
I imagine I was involved with carrying one of the flags, was I?
Yes. In fact, Bruce Wilson marched out behind a young woman bearing a sign that read, Chicago Stings, plural. The teams took to the pitch before 30,000 spectators.
It was quite a big event.
And I had an empty chair sitting next to me in the front row of the VIP box, which was there in case Fidel Castro came to have a look, which he didn't.
Un partido amistoso entre el equipo Chicago Sting.
After the official niceties, it was time to play.
It had rained hard just prior to the game, so the field was a little bit wet.
The Sting were impressed by the Cuban national team's caliber of play. And that's not all that impressed them.
The crowd was good. They were appreciative. When they liked a play, they would clap twice. I thought that was very unusual.
The Cuban national team won 2-0, but Bruce Wilson didn't mind.
You know, playing before a good crowd against a national team was very good preparation for us.
Clive Toy's vision had been that the Cuba trip would generate lots of interest in his fledgling team. But when the Cuban national team traveled to Chicago for a rematch on May 9th at Soldier Field, only 4,000 fans attended. The game ended in a 1-1 draw. But despite the lack of promotional pizzazz, Bruce Wilson considers himself and his Chicago Sting teammates to be trailblazers.
100%. There is no question about it. First American team allowed in there in 20-odd years, and then other teams followed.
That would take another 21 years. In 1999, the Baltimore Orioles played the Cuban national baseball team in Havana. Dan McCrudden agrees that the Chicago Sting was ahead of its time, and he still marvels about his team's trip to Cuba.
To this date, I don't know how Clive got the approval from the U.S. government to fly there.
That's assuming the Sting even sought that approval, or whether the team simply circumvented U.S. law. I asked Clive Toy about that more than once. I got the same answer each time. He doesn't remember.
Well, you know, I wish I could tell you. Might get myself in trouble if I did remember how to tell you.
Sometimes mysteries, even ones involving friendly games of soccer, are best left unsolved.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word this week comes from former Chicago Sting team president Clive Toy, who came from England with this message for Americans.
We'll teach you. We thought, you know, you declared independence. Now you're going to play our game.
I'm Howard Bryant. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.